Campbell versus Florian, and Mr. Rollins, whenever you're ready, we'll hear from you.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. This appeal comes before this court today upon the district court's denial of my clients, Chris Florian and David Tatarsky's motion for summary judgment on the grounds of qualified immunity. First, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Eighth Amendment issue. The standard in an Eighth Amendment issue for a violation of cruel and unusual punishment is deliberate indifference. More specifically, in this case, where we're talking about a couple of prison officials, the standard is, did the prison officials act or fail to act despite knowledge of a substantial or excessive risk of serious harm to an inmate? Now, the magistrate's report and recommendation in this case concluded that there was certainly a risk that Florian and Tatarsky were aware that a court might disagree with their interpretation of the Omnibus Sentence Reduction Act, but there was nothing in the record.
In this case, if we just assume for purposes of argument that there could be an Eighth Amendment violation, the only issue here is qualified immunity, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's when your clients were rendering their opinions, what was the clearly established law as to this statute at that time? Isn't that the issue here, regardless of whether or not the court was right on the Eighth Amendment issue?
Yes, Your Honor, you're correct. And out of a sense of completeness, I certainly wanted to address the Eighth Amendment issue, but it does dovetail overall into the larger issue of qualified immunity. And when you are talking about the issue of qualified immunity, of course, the issue for public officials is, did they violate clearly established rights of which a reasonable person would have been aware? And we know from the guidance provided by cases like Saussure versus Katz that that analysis cannot be overbroad. It's certainly not as simple as, did they understand that it's a violation of constitutional law to keep an inmate in past his release date? That's not the analysis. The question is, was the unlawfulness apparent in light of pre-existing law? And there really was no pre-existing law here. This is a case where both parties admit there was no controlling law on point, because we're talking about a case of, when it came right down to it, what Florian and Tatarsky were trying to do was determine legislative intent. And that is also the analysis that the South Carolina Court of Appeals addressed. And it is also the analysis or the question that the South Carolina Administrative Law Court addressed. And so everybody is talking about legislative intent as being the deciding factor.
But would you agree? I mean, I'm trying to distinguish between two things, and one being the process that your clients went through, and the second is the conclusion that they reached. I understand the plaintiffs to be challenging the process. So, for example, had your clients, instead of like going to Westlaw, instead they'd used one of those magic eight balls to make the decision about what the statute meant, yes or no, right? Shake the eight ball. That would be an Eighth Amendment violation, and you would agree, whether it's clearly established or not, we don't have to get to, but using a magic eight ball to make the determination would be a deliberate indifference or reckless disregard for the rights of the inmates.
Yes, I would agree that the eight ball doesn't cut it.
Right, and so the real question that we've got is, did the process that they used, in light of the statute that we have, is it a reasonably good effort at reaching the right answer? Right? That's the Eighth Amendment sort of question. And it's not just, were they negligent in applying that? They have to be sort of deliberate indifferent to something, right? The text of the statute, for example, right? If they had written in the memo, we're going to ignore the text of the statute, but instead we'll look at some overarching purpose. We might find that that was deliberately indifferent or reckless.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree. And so what we have here is almost a case where their cause of action is an Eighth Amendment violation, but they
you could even insist on a, while you agreed with those hypotheticals, you could probably insist on a even a more difficult formulation, because the Supreme Court has says the deliberate indifference is a subjective notion that has a criminal mens rea. The Supreme Court used criminal mens rea. And there has to be evidence that these two lawyers were subjectively had an intent to deprive these prisoners or recklessly disregarding the standards. Recklessly disregarding risk must have a criminal law mens rea. That's the Supreme Court's Farmer case. And it seems to me that they have to point, or you have to point, or somebody has to point to something in the record to show that was their state of mind when they were going about trying to interpret this statute. And if they were just negligent, they didn't violate the statute, but more importantly, they're immune.
Your Honor, I would certainly agree.
And this memo that they did was not a singular interpretation of this one statute. It was an interpretation of many provisions. It went on pages and pages. There's no suggestion that there was some criminal intent behind the way they phrased it. So using the eight ball hypothetical, there may be that criminal mens rea that's so derelict of their duty that involving the length of prison terms, you might be able to derive that. But the question is, what is the evidence in this record about their mental state?
You're right, and I would suggest that there is none. There is none to suggest that, as you noted, what they were confronted with was a mammoth piece of legislation. I believe the bill was 90 pages in length. That affected literally dozens, if not hundreds, of existing
sentences. How long was their memo?
I think it's in the joint appendix.
I just don't remember.
I can't remember either off the top of my head. But they of course did a memo, and they did a presentation for employees who were in charge of calculating sentencing, and of course, even if they tried to show if the standard was lesser, if it was merely a negligent standard,
Not a negligent standard, and that's not the right hypothetical. In other words, a state court has said they were plainly wrong, and maybe they were negligent, but that's a far cry from deliberate indifference, which requires a criminal mens rea.
Yes, and when you get
you
back to
the state court that said they were right, and all of those decisions came years after the fact of when they were putting together their work product. So that brings me back to what was clearly established at that time.
And
I'm not seeing much of anything.
If there were controlling authority on point, I submit that either myself, my side, or my able opponents would have found it and brought it forward. That they were operating in untried territory, and more than that, we see a situation where the district judge sort of dismisses the judgment of the court of the administrative law court. That was my clients did their work in 2010. As you noted, the Court of Appeals decision comes out in 2015. And in between, you've got the decision of the Administrative Law Court in 2014 that, if anything, tells Florian and Tatarsky, hey, it appears you've got it right. We've analyzed the same issue and we agree. And so we have the district judge withholding qualified immunity on the basis of the language in the Court of Appeals decision, which calls their determination to be unreasonable and patently erroneous. And I would submit to you that, any guidance that decision could have furnished to Florin and Tatarsky was certainly not visible in 2010, because it didn't occur until 2015. And so I would submit there is no authority which determined them to be, that their determination to be unreasonable.
Even if it was unreasonable, it was wrong. Their reasoning was backwards. They didn't understand the principles to be applied. That's a far cry from a mental state where they had some aspect of deliberateness in it.
I would absolutely agree, Your Honor, that that everything, that their arguments about you could have, you could have filed a declaratory judgment action, or you could have asked the Attorney General what he thought about the statute, or you could have asked your boss that runs SCDC what he thought. And what you're saying is you guys as trained attorneys, you're asking you're being employed to make this judgment, and we're saying you should go to your boss and ask him what he thinks and that he should analyze it. It's just not, there's nothing out there, and their own expert admits there's nothing.
Well, you can add that on to the negligence too, but that doesn't get you over the big hump.
It's, right.
Their failure to get further advice was based on some intent to cover up or some intent to hurt the prisoners. The introduction to the statute mitigates all the notions of bad intent. I'm looking at page 220, the introduction to the memo, and they say this is not exhaustive, this is just an explanation, and some of the things are straightforward, and it's basically designed to help. All right,
you're right,
else?
And I would submit to you that this is a panel, and if after hearing the arguments today, two members of this panel should decide one way, and the third member decides a different way, then the panel is not saying we're not saying the odd man out is incompetent or unreasonable. We're saying there's a difference of opinion on the analysis of a legal issue, and it's the same thing with regards to. If this court overrules the district judge's order here on summary judgment, you're not telling the district judge that you're incompetent. You're saying a higher court has reviewed this issue and come to a different conclusion. And by inherent virtue of our power as a superior court, our judgment takes precedence over yours and replaces yours. And that is the situation that makes it so difficult to understand why the district judge would disregard the opinion of the administrative law court, which considered the same issues that the Court of Appeals did and found that in their judgment, Florin and Tatarsky had accurately defined legislative intent. Either the magistrate judge used the correct analysis in his report and recommendation, and we understand that the district judge is not bound by a report and recommendation, but either the magistrate used the correct analysis or he didn't. And the district judge did not use the same analysis in her conclusions, either on the Eighth Amendment issue or the qualified immunity issue.
Anything further?
No.
All right. Mr. Rollins, McKinney?
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Chris Kenny on behalf of Marion Campbell. Where I'd like to begin is with Judge Agee's question about what was clearly established, and then move to Judge Niemeyer and Judge Richardson's questions about the mental state, the sufficiency of the evidence, and the process, because I do think those are basically the three relevant questions. Judge Agee, what was clearly established in 2010 in this circuit and across the country is that it defends the Constitution to prolong the detention of an inmate beyond their lawful
term.
That's
far too general. That's like saying, if I use excessive force when I arrest, I'm violating the Constitution. That doesn't answer a thing.
Well, Your Honor, I do think it does.
Everybody knows you can't sit there and simply extend this person's, the warden couldn't say, okay, Johnny, you're staying in for an extra 10 days because you didn't eat your dinner yesterday. I mean, that violates the Constitution. The question here is whether these guys, in giving an opinion, had a criminal mens rea in trying to deny the prisoners their terms of imprisonment. And that's a you haven't addressed at all, I don't think, in the record, the intent issue, the mental state that has to be applicable. And it seems to me we have to start somewhere, and Eighth Amendment is a good place to start. Another would be is whether it was clearly established. But when you talk about clearly established, you have to do much more particularized. You have to focus it on these people's conduct. So yes. They're sitting there at a desk reading a brand new statute that has never been interpreted, and they're trying to figure out what it says, and they blow it. They do their best, but they blow it. And all of a sudden, you're going to say they're personally liable now for the prison terms of prisoners who sentences were extended because they blew it.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me just push back a little bit. We also can prevail based on a recklessness standard, but I do want to come back to the mens rea after addressing.
Well, recklessness includes that. The Supreme Court explained that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Deliberate indifference includes recklessness, but it requires a criminal mens rea. It has to be a subjective intent. You can't have an objective standard and just look at what other people would do. You have to understand that these people functioned with a mens rea.
Yes, Your Honor. So let's deal with what the evidence shows about what happened in this case.
But before you go to that, and I want to hear about that, Judge Agee's point, you respond by saying it's clearly established you can't prolong detention. But I mean, that's wholly inadequate. And when I read your brief, that seems to be the argument you're making. But that's an insufficient level of detail, right? That's the broad brushstrokes, right? You can't violate someone's Fourth Amendment rights. All right, that's clearly established, but you got to show exactly something that's at least analogous, if not directly on point. And I don't see any case law in the Fourth Circuit that suggests that what the lawyers did here violates that Eighth Amendment standard.
Yes, Your Honor. So let me deal with it this way. First of all, I disagree with our friends on the other side that you would have to have a declaration as to this particular statute before these defendants under a certain set of facts.
Tell us what the best evidence you have of something clearly established in 2010 is that relates to this statute or type of statute. Because like Judge Richardson, I haven't seen that.
Well, Your Honor, we agree that the statute was enacted in 2010. It was a new statute. I don't think there's... we don't stand on that proposition. What I would stand on is you can look at cases like Haygood or Sample or any number of cases that the particulars of the facts on the ground may differ. But the proposition, and there are arguable cases that you could easily argue negligence or deliberate indifference in those cases. But when there's a failure to act by a prison official who is clearly on notice, that risks prolonged detention. That is potentially an Eighth Amendment violation.
No, but what you got to show is you're missing the point, at least for here, right? I understand your argument. It doesn't have to be this statute. But if you had a case that said it is a violation of the Eighth Amendment for a lawyer applying a statute, any statute, to rely on the text and ignore some amorphous purpose, right, that scenario, if you had a case that said that, then it would be clearly established. I mean, that's what happened here, right? The guys rely on the text. They ignore undefined purpose. The district court says you should have ignored the text and relied only on the purpose. But you don't have any case that suggests that the officer's reliance on the actual text of the statute is unreasonable and is a violation of the Eighth Amendment.
Well, Judge Richardson, let me resist the premise a little bit because we don't agree that they...
I understand, except my hypothetical.
They ignored the test. But to accept your hypothetical...
All right. Let me just say, at least start with that for now.
Yes, sir.
Assume you got to get past that point.
Yes, sir. What we would say is, respectfully, that the right here, as our friends would frame it, and as some of the panel's questions are framing it, is too narrowly drawn. And the reason... There can never be an endless series of precedents.
Well, be as specific as you can as to what you say the right is in this case.
Yes, sir.
And hopefully we can all agree that if you say the right is a violation of the Eighth Amendment, you might as well sit down. So tell us as specifically as possible exactly what you say the right is here.
Yes, Your Honor. The right here is that prison officials cannot ignore plain instruction as to when inmates be released. What the fundamental problem, to bring it back to
Judge
Richardson.
I thought this case was against the lawyers.
Yes, Your Honor, and they were lawyers for the Department of Corrections. And the fundamental problem with what they did here.
I mean, what you just said is nothing more than what you said in the beginning. Keeping somebody beyond his term violates the Eighth Amendment, and that is not at issue anywhere. There's no specificity. So you have to make it factually relevant to the case here, in some sense. So you have to focus on the conduct of the attorneys and say, what did they do in light of what law that made it clear that what they were doing was a violation of the Eighth Amendment?
Judge Niemeyer, let me give you a couple of specific examples in this case. For the first example I would say is these lawyers read a statute that says parole to mean no parole. Okay, that is the first problem. The second problem, Judge Niemeyer, if you go
you
back—
think they did that deliberately or they did that as a matter of their take on what should be construed?
Your Honor, the way I read the record is they were reckless in doing it, and let me tell you why. If you look at page 220 of the Joint Appendix, it's a six-page memo.
I've got it here.
Yes,
Your Honor. I've read the whole memo.
And what it indicates is that there was clear apprehension as to what the consequence of this parole-no parole distinction is. Now, there's clear apprehension. The question then becomes, should they have done something beyond that? We submit they should have. What did they do? They did nothing. The record indicates the totality of Mr. Florian's analysis is the memo that Your Honors have, a PowerPoint presentation that you can find at page 89, and the act itself. That is the totality of the analysis. Now,
which lawyers for government agencies do by the hundreds every day. But what makes this difference? What is the factor you say that clearly shows they acted with the wrong purpose here?
Judge Agee, it is the simple fact that parole does not mean no parole in the South Carolina Criminal Code. And there are very severe consequences that I don't believe are disputed for that distinction. And so what happened here is you had a lawyer who, in faced with a statute that says parole, then interpreted and instructed department officials to apply it as a no parole statute. If you go back and look at Act 273, it's not like the General Assembly was hiding the ball.
Can I ask a question then? So based on your theory, if hypothetically I disagree with that premise, right? So instead of saying parole means no parole, instead I believed in a hypothetical that they got the text of the statute exactly right. And the state court of appeals got it wrong in the hypothetical that I've got. We're applying a federal standard here. If that's true, do you agree that you do not prevail, that you lose?
Your Honor, if you believe that you can decide Boleyn differently, then that...
No, I don't have to decide it differently. I'm just saying, as a matter of federal law, right?
Yes.
When I'm evaluating the mental state, right? I believe, what I'm trying to distinguish here is procedure and substance.
Yes, sir.
Right? What I'm trying to say is, let's assume that they substantively got it right. Mm-hmm. So that, and Boleyn got it wrong, but they substantively got it right. Are you making a separate argument about procedure? Or is that, if that conclusion holds, I'm not saying this is a hypothetical, right? It's the point. If that conclusion holds, then you agree that they're entitled to qualified immunity.
If Florian and Tatarsky were substantively correct about how to read the act,
yes.
I don't believe we can prevail.
Okay.
The problem is, and you're right about procedure, and I want to talk about procedure, we could lose this case at trial very easily if the jury buys into the idea that there's some testimony about this, that, oh, we did a lot of work. We debated this. We rigorously analyzed it. There is also evidence, and the district court credited that evidence, that essentially they had apprehension as evidenced by their own memo. They did, based on the case file they produced in discovery, there is little work other than the memo itself. And you have to get around Boleyn and the Court of Appeals finding that their conclusion was unreasonable and it ignored Section 1 of the Act.
Wait, why do you have to get around that? That was years later. You still haven't told us anything that was clearly established in 2010.
Yes, Your Honor.
What if you didn't have Boleyn? What if you didn't have those cases?
Yes.
You're just coming to court and saying, arguing these prisoners, they misread the statute, and you demonstrate to us now they misread the statute, and these prisoners therefore had a longer stay in prison.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Qualified immunity?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe so. And here's why. What I agree with you, we would end up litigating that question in front of the district court.
No, just on the argument. In other words, there are no state court decisions.
Yes.
We have their opinion letter.
Yes.
And you're coming up here, and prisoners have been released later than they otherwise should have. And you said, man, they got it wrong. They violated his Eighth Amendment rights because they got it so wrong. And you argue to us that they misconstrued it. What are we supposed to do with that?
Well, Your Honor, I believe it depends on the sufficiency of the record to support a deliberate indifference finding.
No, this record. The only thing I'm eliminating are the court opinions.
Yes, sir. On this record, I believe you cannot find that when the General Assembly said that these are now parolable offenses, we should go ahead and instruct the calculation team at Department of Corrections to release these people based on...
So you think they were deliberately indifferent?
I believe that, yes, sir, reckless.
There was a criminal mens rea.
I believe it was a recklessness. Yes, sir. I do. There's
civil recklessness and criminal recklessness. Mm-hmm. And we've defined that, our court has defined that, to be the difference between a subjective standard and objective. In the civil, it's objective. But in the criminal, there's got to be a subjective state of mind.
Well, Judge Niemeyer, let me say, I mean, you know, to their credit, Florian Tatarski testified that they were aware this was a significant reform. They were aware the General Assembly was trying to alter sentencing. They were aware that this was going to have a huge impact on hundreds of inmates. And based on what they concede, it's not like we're inferring their subjective state based on, you know, pieces of evidence, based on what they testified to, what they're aware of. A jury and the district court believes there's sufficient evidence here to find that they were recklessness, that they acted.
So all these lawyers in the various state agencies, Department of Justice and the state agencies, are giving opinions on a regular daily basis, and they really blow one. They're doing their best, but they really blow one. They're now going to be answering out of their personal pocketbook for the injuries they caused to the public.
Well, no,
I mean,
sir.
Not
necessarily. And let me reiterate, and you can look at all the cases that we cite in our brief. There are plenty of examples.
But you haven't cited a single case where an attorney gives an opinion that gives rise to deliberate indifference.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. To be candid, I'm not aware of one.
And isn't that the whole test? In other words, to bring the Eighth Amendment down to this case, you have to conclude that their conduct in giving this opinion was clearly established violation, if they were really wrong, clearly established violation of the Eighth Amendment.
Yes, Your Honor, and to make that determination, I don't believe their status as lawyers matters. If you look at
well, that's
the case,
their function. They're performing a legal opinion.
Absolutely. But, Your Honor, we could easily have a case, and there's examples of the calculation staff or sheriff or any number of—
We're not talking about administrative. We're talking about an opinion. In other words, we're talking about lawyers making judgment calls about a text and giving opinions.
Judge Niemeyer, let me push back.
There's
on
a lot
that.
Of difference between that and somebody— not paying attention to administratively. In other words, the order says he's supposed to be released on the 15th, and the warden says, well, the 30th is good enough for me.
Your Honor, I don't see a lot of deliberation or analysis going on in this record. What I see, based on their memo, based on their PowerPoint, is a conclusion, but no explanation how we get there.
Okay, now, let's say they're negligent. But, these guys may not be high-powered lawyers. I don't know one way or the other. But they gave a memo on many provisions of the statute. And they explained up front that they were just doing this basically as a guidance, and they were not addressing everything. And then they go page by page on each of them. And the stuff that you're concerned about is on one of the six pages. And they give their opinion there. And you basically say they were indifferent to the Eighth Amendment with a malicious intent, a deliberate indifference.
Well, recklessness, Your Honor. I read the record.
Criminal recklessness. You've got to come to grips with that.
Yeah.
And you're not. Farmer made this absolutely clear.
Your Honor, I don't I read the record as no meaningful effort to determine when these individuals should be released. That's how I read the record. And respectfully, what I would submit.
All right, and so, but then we go back to, and I just want to make sure I understand your argument.
Yes, sir.
The only argument you're making with respect to it being clearly established is what you make on page 22, which is the citation to an unpublished Fourth Circuit case and a district court case from South Carolina. And that's the only thing from the Fourth Circuit that you're relying on. And then you rely on these out-of-circuit cases to suggest that their general principles ought to be, you know, read into South Carolina as clearly established. That's the extent of the clearly established argument that you're making. You are not making anything beyond that.
Your Honor, we believe that authority establishes the right. Yes, that's correct. And let me just say this.
Established about, in the past. It had to be established when they were functioning.
Judge Niemeyer, you're correct.
Right. Yeah.
And let me just say this. As I read this court's precedent, the question is, should it have been apparent to reasonable prison officials that they were required to do something more?
That's the wrong standard. It has to be subjectively. It's not a reasonable objective standard. That's my whole point, and that's where I think your whole brief and where your argument goes. You have to show intent in these specific persons.
Judge Niemeyer, I was referring, and if I was unclear.
You said reasonable person, which is.
That's the purpose of the qualified immunity analysis.
That's a qualified immunity statute, but if I have a violation of the Eighth Amendment, it's even more difficult.
Yes, sir. All I was trying to point out is that under the qualified immunity, the purpose of qualified immunity is to distinguish between holding people accountable and allowing reasonable state actors to perform their work. And the question here, and what I respectfully submit, the question here is whether this record would allow a jury to conclude it is something more than negligence. We understand that there is a tough road in the district court and that these arguments will be raised with the jury, and a jury will have to decide whether or not the activity or lack of activity, in our view, was sufficient, was something short of recklessness. We understand that. It is a high burden. We acknowledge it. But respectfully, what our friends on the other side and many of the questions this morning deal with is quarreling with the district court's view of the facts. And under this court's precedent, that is not.
Well, basically, the district court said, look at the South Carolina Court of Appeals decision. They said these guys were unreasonable. I don't have to address anything. I don't see whether the district court ever addressed what the clearly established law was. But before your time runs out, let's go back one more time. Tell us with specificity what you say the right is that's relevant in this case.
Your Honor, the right is to be released based on the instruction of the General Assembly, based on a clear statute that requires no construction. And that's what Act 273 was.
And the best, give us the best case in or out of circuit that suggests that right was clearly established. That right with respect to a statute mandating release.
If I could give you two,
sure.
Briefly, I'd encourage you to look at Haygood. For this reason, there is a dispute about state law that gives rise to the failure to release. There was still a jury question in that case. And then with respect to Sample, you had a situation where there was a mistake about how to apply a statute. Those were both, application of state law. We think you can rely on any of those cases or any of the other district court cases that we cited. There's nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Mr. Rollins.
Yes, Your Honors. I had asked that some time be reserved for a rebuttal argument. And one of the things that's incumbent on counsel now is when it's time to quit beating a dead horse. And I'm confident that the panel has grasped our arguments and our issues. And I'm
Tell
not
me what Haygood, what's this, Haygood stand for?
Well, the part of Haygood that I'm familiar with says, in the context of prison officials, there's got to be knowledge of a substantial or excessive risk of harm to an inmate, and then you fail to act, and so it brings us right back to the same question: Well, how do we get?
But see, they're not releasing the inmates. They're not even applying the statute. They are interpreting the statute. And Haygood basically just addressed the notion that extending somebody's time in prison violates the Eighth Amendment. It's a cruel and unusual punishment. And the question is, were these guys deliberately indifferent to that in the sense that they subjectively understood the law as a reasonable person, clearly understood the law at the time with respect to this particular statute, and that they violated it?
And the record doesn't show that. And so what we're left with is confronting the plaintiff's argument, which you hear an attempt to rephrase it again and again in a palatable format, but they're not really finding it, because what they're saying is, okay, you guys admitted you knew that this statute was, or this Omnibus Reform Act was significant, and that it was going to potentially affect a lot of inmates. And you knew that, you know, if you got it wrong, that the consequences could be significant for an aide if a parolable offense is held to be non-parolable. And so, aha, we got you. So you knew all that. You knew it was important, and you didn't do enough. Well, the question is not, you know, the question is, the concept is, knowing that you are doing something that's important and has consequences is not remotely the same thing as knowing that you're doing it wrong, or even suspecting that you're doing it wrong. And there's just nothing in the record that shows at the time they did their analysis and made their determinations of what that act was supposed to mean that should have put them on notice that they were doing it wrong.
Basically, the immunity requires a showing that they violated clearly established law.
Yes.
That was known to them and would be known to anybody in their state, and they violated it, ignored it.
Yes, Your Honor. What the South Carolina Court of Appeals did was to overrule the judgment of a lower court and of a couple of practicing attorneys. It didn't transform what they did, what Florian and Tatarsky did, into a violation of constitutional law.
All right, thank you. We'll adjourn court till tomorrow morning and come down and recounsel.